Welcome everyone to tonight's archive. This is the first of our series for evolutionary lawyers through February of 2012. My name is Molly Rowan Leach. I'm the founder of Molly Rowan Presents. I'm a dialogue host, and my main focus and voice is in the transformation of the justice system, criminal justice system. I'm co-hosting this evolutionary lawyers series with the amazing J. Kim Wright, who is an attorney, an author of the ABA best-selling book, Lawyers as Peacemakers, and also the founder of Cutting Edge Law. Tonight's archive features the incredible Rian Eisler. Tonight's archive date is November 14th, 2011, and Rian Eisler is hailed by Desmond Tutu, Gloria Steinem, and many world officials as one of the cutting-edge leaders in systems change. She's an attorney, a prolific author, and a macro historian. And I hope that you'll enjoy this archive call again with Rian Eisler during our Evolutionary Lawyers series through February 2012. More information can be found about this series at cuttingedgelaw.com. Thank you and enjoy.
Well, welcome everyone. This is Kim Wright, and so glad to have you all here this evening at our special time. I couldn't be more honored to have our guest tonight, and I'll say more about who she is and some of her accomplishments in just a moment. But we want to start with having my co-host Molly tell us how the phone lines work so that we can have our technology handled first thing. So Molly, will you tell us that? And I guess we want to remind people that this is being recorded.
Yes, thank you so much, Kim, and a warm welcome to everyone tonight to our Evolutionary Lawyers series, which is a weekly series every Monday. And we're thrilled tonight to have our special guest, which of course Kim will be introducing in just one moment. My name is Molly Rowan Leach of Molly Rowan Presents, and just a few notes about the space of this call, housekeeping-wise. Throughout the call tonight, you'll get an opportunity, when prompted, to ask questions and make reflections or comments. To do that, all you have to do is press 1 on your keypad. This is an interactive teleconferencing software, so it's really a great way to take it to the next level. I think that's all for housekeeping. Thanks, Kim.
Thanks, Molly. Thanks for holding down the back end for us. So, again, it is my honor to bring to you Rian Eisler, and I'm going to only tell you part of her bio, because if we discussed all of her many accomplishments and all of her many honors, we would be here for the entire hour just reciting what this amazing woman has created in the world. So she is a social scientist, attorney, and author whose work on cultural transformation has inspired both scholars and social activists. She has been a leader in the movement for peace, sustainability, and economic equity, and her pioneering work in human rights has expanded the focus of international organizations to include the rights of women and children. She's internationally known for her bestseller, The Chalice and the Blade, Our History, Our Future, which is now in 23 foreign editions, including most European languages, Chinese, Russian, Korean, Hebrew, Japanese, and Arabic. Her newest book is called The Wealth of Nations, Creating a Caring Economics, and it was hailed by Archbishop Desmond Tutu as a template for the better world we have been so urgently seeking, by Peter Senge as desperately needed, and by Gloria Steinem as revolutionary. Jane Goodall called it a call for action, and the book proposes a new approach to economics that gives visibility and value to the most essential human work, the work of caring for people and the planet. Her other books has been drawn from her multidisciplinary research, award-winning The Power of Partnership and Tomorrow's Children, as well as Sacred Pleasure, which is a daring reexamination of sexuality and spirituality. Women, Men, and the Global Quality of Life, documenting the key role of women's status and a nation's general quality of life. And then her earlier books were widely used for the campaign for the Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. She teaches in the Transformative Leadership Program at the California Institute of Integral Studies and is a commissioner of the World Commission on Global Consciousness and Spirituality, along with the Dalai Lama and other spiritual leaders. She is the only woman among 20 great thinkers, including Hegel, Adam Smith, Marx, and Toynbee, selected for inclusion in Macro History and Macro Historians in recognition of the lasting importance of her work as a cultural historian and evolutionary theorist. She's won numerous awards, honorary PhDs, and is included in the award-winning book Great Peacemakers as one of the 20 leaders for world peace, along with Mahatma Gandhi, Mother Teresa, and Martin Luther King. Please join me in welcoming her to our call.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Kim. And with all of you, I would like to offer, it's interesting, you said the wealth of nations, and it's the real wealth of nations.
Okay.
And of course, I took the name from the Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, but added something very important. The real wealth of nations, because it introduces.
Please tell us.
What?
Please tell us, for anybody who might not know your work, please tell us more about that.
Well, I can tell you a lot more about that, but I thought maybe I could start by saying, telling a little bit about myself, because I am an attorney. And although I'm also a social scientist and assistant scientist, my work to really transform social systems and cultural beliefs started by actually using a great deal my legal training. So do you think that's a good place to start?
That's a wonderful place to start.
Okay. Well, I noticed in the email that you asked me whether there was did I feel a call to the law? And the answer is absolutely not. I took of that because it was the shortest, it was shorter than getting a PhD, and it was more practical. But it wasn't really law that drew me. When I went to UCLA Law School, and I graduated in the top, I think I was second or third in my class in 1965. But what was interesting was that the class that I liked the most, the class that spoke to me, was constitutional law. And indeed, when I first graduated, I joined an entertainment law firm in Beverly Hills. I thought that would be entertaining. And that's where I was at that time in my life, in the mid-60s. But then a lot of things happened, and I quit my job and my marriage and smoking within a period of 3 months. I mean, I was done at that point. And I really threw myself into both the human potential movement and the then civil rights and later women's liberation movement. And it was there that I started to very much draw on my background as an attorney. I founded the first center in the United States at that time on women and the law. And, you know, it was really interesting when you said women and the law in the, you know, late 60s, people looked at you blankly, like, what could that possibly mean? Well, one thing it meant was that as late as 1969, through the Los Angeles Women's Center Legal Program, I wrote a friend of the court brief to the Supreme Court of the United States, arguing the then radical notion that women should be considered persons under the purview of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and they didn't buy it, those guys. I mean, it was all guys at that time. But it did pave the way for the Reed case, which just came a few months later, and where we were finally sort of given personhood, and I was horrified. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry when a recent newspaper piece, and I wrote an op-ed about it, Scalia said, well, really, women are not really protected under the 14th Amendment. It was, of course, you know, I mean, it's sort of bizarre, the backlash and the regression that has happened since then. But I really threw myself into using the law. We, at the time, the want ads were segregated by sex. All the good jobs were help wanted male, and all the lousy dead end quote helper jobs were help wanted female. So, you know, before you even got to the gate, you were out. I testified at rape hearings because, you know, basically rape at that time, a rape, women wouldn't file for rape because it was a judgment of them rather than of their attacker. And yes, as you mentioned, I did write, because I did divorce law for a while. And so I wrote a book called Dissolution, No Fault Divorce, Marriage and the Future of Women, which really predicted the what we call now the feminization of poverty. That while the old law was a farce, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, no fault divorce was going to plunge middle-class women and their children into poverty, which it did. And then I also wrote the Equal Rights Handbook, which was the only mass paperback. It was published, my first book on marriage, divorce, and the future of women, Dissolution, was published by McGraw-Hill. And this one was published by Avon, and it was the only mass paperback, really debunking some of those ridiculous falsehoods about what ERA would do. And, you know, it was a simple amendment. It was that equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States, that's the federal government, or any state on the basis of sex. I mean, it was like milquetoast. And yet it was defeated. And it was at that point that it became clear to me that as much as we have to change laws, what we really have to change are cultural beliefs and social institutions. And that led to a whole new chapter in my life. And I think I'll pause for you to say something here.
Well, I'm fascinated. Let me just say I'm kind of sitting here with my mouth open hearing this. And I wonder, you said that the law wasn't a calling, but what you're starting to describe feels like it might have been a calling. And whether that is how it occurred for you, or if you were just sort of compelled. I mean, there's sort of the sense of the calling as an opening, and then there's the sense of the calling as something you just push towards. Which would you say was happening? And then please do continue.
Well, as I said, at that time, after I graduated, I wanted to be an entertainment lawyer, you know, with the Beverly Hills law firm. What that means, as you probably know, and as I realized one day as I decided to quit my job, was that I would get to sort of massage the egos of all these entertainment people and help them count their money. And I didn't want to do that. I mean, that was just of absolutely no interest to me. But I really didn't have a calling. My calling is based on some other life experiences, and I wasn't really aware of what my calling was until I sort of woke up. So that's why I believe that changes in consciousness lead to action. Of course, action leads to even more changes in consciousness. But first of all was my experience as a Holocaust survivor. As a small child, my parents and I had to flee the Nazis from my native Vienna. And we would have been killed. I mean, had we stayed, as were most of my relatives, my grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins. And I witnessed on Kristallnacht, so-called because of the all the glass that was shattered in Jewish homes and synagogues and businesses, real brutality and cruelty. A gang of Gestapo men broke into our home and dragged my father off. But I also saw something that I really didn't realize at that time was pivotal in my life. I saw what I today call spiritual courage. Because, you know, we think of courage, we've been taught to think of courage, right, as the courage to slay the dragon, to kill the enemy. But spiritual courage is the courage to stand up against injustice out of love. And my mother displayed that. She could have been killed, but she recognized one of the Gestapo men as a young man who had been an errand boy for the family business, and she got furious. She said, "How dare you come here and do this to this man who was so kind to you? I want him back. I want him back." And as I said, she could have been killed. Many people were killed. Many Jewish people were killed that night. But by a miracle, she wasn't, and by another miracle, we escaped. And I had to ask myself as the years went by whether all this cruelty and brutality really is inevitable, as we're often told. You know, that it's just human nature, you know, original sin, selfish genes, whatever, or whether there are alternatives. And if so, what are these alternatives? Because it was very clear to me that the conventional categories, like right versus left, or religious versus secular, or Eastern versus Western, I mean, you can have horrible regimes on both sides, that they were useless. In fact, a colleague of mine calls these old categories weapons of mass distraction, because they really make it impossible for us to see what it is that I was looking for in my multicultural, cross-disciplinary, cross-cultural research, which were patterns, configurations that either support our capacities for, yeah, for cruelty, for violence, you know, because we've got those, or our capacities, which we obviously also have, for caring, for empathy, for nonviolence. In other words, we have both these capacities. So the real issue, and we know that today from neuroscience, is that our brains develop in interaction with our experiences, and these experiences are formed by our environments, mostly our cultural environments, as mediated, you know, through families and through well, through legal systems, educational systems, religious systems, political, economic systems, and so on. So I really set on my own research, because my first job before I went back to law school had been as a systems scientist at an offshoot of the RAND Corporation, the Systems Development Corporation. So I was used to really looking at the whole system. But I didn't start my research until another pivotal experience in my life, and that was in the late 60s when I suddenly woke up along with thousands of other women as if from a long drugged sleep, and I realized that as much as having been born Jewish had obviously completely, you know, impacted my life, having been born female had also had a huge impact on my life. I mean, like, for example, from law school, I was, you know, second or third in my class, but none of the big law firms offered me a job because I was a woman. It was that simple in those days. But it was much more than that, of course, because I was supposed to go to college to get my MRS degree, my Mrs. degree. I mean, that was the 50s, the 60s, much of the 60s, that was the thing. So when I started my research, I really drew from a much larger database, one that includes not, you know, what the so-called important studies look at, which we're always told, you know, that's the study of man, right? And then we're told, don't worry, man includes woman. Well, of course it doesn't. Just look at the books. I included a database that includes both the female and male halves of humanity, and also, and this is very important, not just politics and economics as conventionally defined, as most of these studies do, but also where we all live, our family and other intimate relations. And I began to see these connections, these configurations, and I saw that actually of the status of women and the status of children in a society was one of the most important factors in whether that society was more equitable or inequitable, more peaceful or more violent, everything. And that is what I've been writing about in my books, including most recently about economics, because the subtitle of The Real Wealth of Nations is Creating a Caring Economics. And you know very well that caring is considered soft, stereotypically feminine, not efficient. And what my research and the research of many others now shows again and again is that, on the contrary, that investing in caring for people, starting in early childhood, and investing in caring for our natural habitat is the best and most economically efficient investment that a society can make. And again, I'm going to stop so that you can say something.
Okay. Well, everything you say makes so much sense to me, and yet we are living in a world that the culture has for centuries been male dominated. So what is your work and sort of like, are you taking that head on, or are you doing as Buckminster Fuller talked about, creating the parallel system? What's
my work is both deconstruction, because we have to look at the reality, and that's not about blame, by the way. We're talking about systems. Women in domination systems, look at Iran, for example, where women demonstrated and said, no, women are too, quote, emotional to be judges. Well, give me a break. I mean, in that totally irrational culture, right? I mean, women are irrational. You know, I mean, women don't have any say. So it's not about blame. It's about really looking at the realities. It's about looking at quantitative work, like the study we did at the Center for Partnership Studies called Women, Men, and the Global Quality of Life, showing that the status of women can, in significant respects, be a better predictor of general quality of life than GDP. Looking at some of the new studies like the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap reports and their Global Competitiveness reports, showing, lo and behold, that if you take those two reports together now, the countries that have the smallest gender gap, which are the Nordic nations, Sweden, Finland, Norway, they also invariably rank high, not only at the top ranks of the United Nations Human Development Reports, but of the World Economic Forum's Global Competitiveness Reports. That's part of it. But the other part is what I call reconstruction. And I don't see it as a parallel universe, as an alternative universe. Now, the good news, of course, if we look at society from the perspective of what I call the configuration of a domination system, you know, top-down rule, the ranking of man over man over woman, man over nature, race over race, religion over religion, et cetera, an authoritarian rule in both the family and the state or tribe, and the equation of, quote, real masculinity with domination, with conquest, with violence, as compared to the partnership configuration, and it's always a matter of degree, it's a partnership-domination continuum, the partnership configuration, which you see much more in these nations, in the Nordic nations, much more real democracy in both the family, and the state, trying to leave behind these traditions of violence. For example, they pioneered the first laws saying that physical discipline against children in families is against the law. They have a very strong men's movement to disentangle masculinity from its association, cultural association with domination, with violence, that's what real men do. And yes, they have a much more equal partnership between the female and male half of humanity. So women are approximately 40%, 40% of the national legislatures. And what happens then is that the value system changes and the institutions change, because men, for one thing, no longer find it such a threat to their identity, to their so-called masculinity, to also embrace more stereotypically feminine activities and priorities. I mean, it's only as the status of women has risen, say, in the United States, that we see more fathers doing fathering in the old way, once considered totally inappropriate for men, you know, diapering babies, feeding babies, carrying babies, you know, the mothering, the caring work. And it's the same with these nations. They were very, very poor at the beginning of the 20th century, so poor there were famines. And one of the reasons that they are doing so well today, and by the way, Sweden is one of the few nations that today has a higher GDP than it had before the economic crisis, okay? So caring policies pay. They pay very well, mm-hmm. and they did not institute these terrible austerity, so-called austerity measures, which really are a redistribution of wealth from those at the bottom to those on the top. But, I mean, it's part of the domination system. It's not capitalism per se. It's not socialism per se. It's domination economics. What we really see there is that they have universal health care. They have very high quality early childhood education, government subsidized, of course. They have stipends to help parents care for their children. They have government supported, very generous paid parental leave for both mothers and fathers. And what's so interesting is we're today being told, oh, well, you know, those are the things that have to go. Well, actually, nations like Sweden, like Germany, for example, which among the European economies has also some of the best family-friendly policies, are the ones that are doing well. So we really need new lenses, don't we, to look at things. But they invested, and this is really one of the central themes of the real Wealth of Nations, they invested in our human capacity development. And economists never tire of telling us that the most important capital for our post-industrial knowledge service economy is high-quality human capital. Well, that's not just developed in universities, as important as that is. We know from neuroscience that it largely hinges on the quality of care children receive early on. So our policies today are not only inhuman, what's happening, but they are economically suicidal. And we've got to change it. And that's why through the Center for Partnership Studies, and I really invite everyone to go on that website, it's partnershipway.org, we have our Caring Economics campaign. And I will again pause for you, because I seem to go on a roll with you, don't I?
Well, I'm fine with that. I wonder if you could comment on the Occupy movement and how you see that being related or not to what you're talking about.
Well, we can't occupy Wall Street or whatever it is. We have to transform it. We have a program through our Caring Economics campaign, which are online 7-session leadership training webinars. And they're fabulous, and the people are fabulous, and some of our people are now going to the various Occupy movement sites and really bringing the conversation around to the positive. What can we do? Well, there are many elements to caring economics, but it's really basically about what do we value. And for example, speculation, a tax on speculation and financial speculation would solve many of our problems, including our deficit problems, because these transactions create no real value, as we really saw when the credit swaps, the derivatives all melted into thin air. Bringing the message that, look, the real wealth of a nation, the real wealth of our world, consists of the contributions of people and of nature. So we need what we have not had: economic measurements, economic policies, economic practices that give real visibility and real value to the most important human work, the work of caring for people starting in early childhood and caring for our Mother Earth. And that's what basically our Caring Economics campaign is about. We have three elements of it. One is we're working on what we call social wealth indicators. And the question we're trying to answer is basically, well, what are the real drivers that make it possible for a society to ensure that all of its people can really develop and express their potentials? Now, that's a very profound human question, an evolutionary question, of course, but it's also a very practical economic question, especially now, as I said, in the post-industrial knowledge service economy. And we have been working on this with the Urban Institute. We've been having conversations with the people at the State of the USA and the National Academies because we now, for the first time, there's a program congressionally approved of new key national indicators that will supplement GDP. And we want to be sure that, unlike so many of the new indicators like the Stiglitz-Sarkozy and others, that they really do give visibility and value to the work of caring and caregiving in both the market and non-market household economies. Very, very important, as you can see from the example of Sweden, Finland, and Norway. And, of course, we also are putting together the Alliance for a Caring Economy, which is, it'll have its own website in a few weeks, I think, an alliance of organizations. Many organizations have already signed up, and I invite all of you to get, you can find out about it on our website, partnershipway.org, get your organizations to become part of this coalition, which, among other things, of course, will push for new economic indicators, social wealth indicators, because look, what's not counted is not going to be funded, is not going to get priority, and it's our job to completely change the economic conversation and consciousness. And thereby, we have a chance to not only move forward in evolution and to alleviate terrible human suffering, but also to not lose our foothold in the global economy, which is where, you know, we have the highest child poverty rates, the highest maternal mortality poverty rates, the highest incarceration rates of any industrialized nation. I mean, this is insane. And it doesn't have to be that way. So when you ask me, is it working on we're trying to get the Occupy movement to really have a positive central message, and the message is, let's go deeper. Let's leave behind this old conversation about capitalism versus socialism. Obviously, we need both a market and government planning, government regulation, but let's move to a caring economics.
That's great. I want to open up the lines for other people to ask questions. Here in just a moment. Molly, do we have any hands up yet? Or I just said that. Why don't we go ahead, and since you're the one that can see whose hands are up, why don't we go ahead and hear from some of the people, and let's see what they want to know.
Wonderful. Thank you. Go ahead, Mary Lynn.
Okay. Yes, Ms. Eisler, I would like to know what you think about what role the media can play in all of this. Is there something very specific that the media can do to help to birth this transformation?
Absolutely. The question isn't really what it can do, but what it will do. And that depends on us. I really invite all of you. We have a blog, Voices of Partnership, and we're also going to have an Alliance for a Caring Economy blog when that website is up. But we can't just have it on our blogs. Go into the internet conversation. That is something you can do. You can also write op-eds, frankly. It's really up to us. The media by themselves aren't going to change the conversation until there's a lot of noise made about a different conversation. They're stuck. I also invite you, in order to be really well equipped to do this, to consider enrolling in our webinar 7-session training programs. I do one of the sessions where there's a conversation with me. But I mean, the things that the people who are graduating from these sessions are doing is phenomenal. Because, I mean, they're doing presentations all over the world. I mean, people from Kenya, from South Africa, from Canada, from Ireland, New Zealand, of course, the United States. I mean, one woman, for example, has been presenting to homemaker groups, really telling these women what's true, that they are contributing so much to our, not just our society, but to our economy. Because what we really should be investing in are parenting classes. We should be investing in high-quality early childhood education. And, yes, elder care. I mean, to just discard a population that's getting older and not being that sick if they stay away from the conventional, you know, lifestyle, including all the drugs, we should use our talents. So family planning, for example, is essential. Even in this United States, we have the highest birth rates. Well, it's not the highest birth rates only. We have the highest population growth of any industrialized nation, which, given the level of consumption, we can't have an economy that just depends on consumption of all these things that are actually many of them making us sick or distracting us from leading meaningful lives and doing what we want. So we're talking about real systems work, and I really think that the media, including what we do on the internet, have a very, very important educational role. So I invite you to be part of it.
I'll mention that Mary Lynn is actually an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker. So it's hopeful that she would ask that question.
Well, Emmy Lynn, I've been in many documentaries. I was just in a wonderful documentary called Mother, Caring for 7 Billion, which really used my work quite a bit. But because we also have to start talking about population. I mean, of course there's misdistribution of resources, but we do have a limited, as Bucky Fuller pointed out, we have a limited carrying capacity in the world, and it's totally unsustainable. But so I invite you, get in touch with us if you're an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, because, yes, it would be wonderful to have you do something with that. With Caring Economics, the time is now.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other hands? Molly?
Just a reminder, please press 1 on your keypad if you do have a question tonight. And I actually would like to just make a quick comment that perhaps might be a question as well, if I might.
Sure.
You know, Rianne, you touched on something that I really keyed in on around, first of all, the spiritual courage, and then also you spoke to underlying our laws and our systems, of course, is consciousness. And I wondered if you might just speak a little bit more about the interrelationship between consciousness and systems, and how we move into and become the transformation and the solution.
Well, I actually wrote one of my books, The Power of Partnership, really addresses that interrelationship. It's the central theme of the book, how basically, as our consciousness changes, We take action, and as we take action, then we're able to change the consciousness of others and ourselves. And nothing is a linear cause and effect in the universe. It's all interactive, as you know. So I think, though, that to talk only, and I mean, this is where I differ with some of what is said about spirituality, that so much of the preaching about we should be nicer, we should be kinder, yeah, all of it is true, but if that were going to really do it, we would have a very different world. We really have to create the conditions, and that's when we're talking about changes in beliefs and changes in social structures. I mean, for example, we have grown up in a world where anything that is stereotypically associated with women or the feminine, whether in a woman or a man, whether in business or social policy, is devalued. So we constantly have this message somehow that really it's just a women's issue. Well, if you look at our world today, these things that are supposed to be just women's issues, like care for children, like access to family planning, like valuing in both men and women, less violence, more caring behaviors. Not that all women are caring, by the way, by any means, and in domination systems, women are actually agents of dominator socialization. Remember I said that at the very beginning, you know, we're all part of the system. So consciousness that there is, first of all, a traditions of domination that we have to leave behind. And second of all, consciousness that there is what I call a partnership alternative, and that does not mean just working together. People cooperate all the time in domination systems, okay? Terrorists cooperate, invading armies cooperate, monopolies cooperate, and it does not mean a completely flat organization. We have to have loci of responsibilities, parents, teachers, managers, leaders, but we need to move towards what I call hierarchies of actualization rather than hierarchies of domination, where power is used to empower rather than disempower both ourselves and others. So it's a whole new set of social categories, a new set of analytical lenses. And it is really that consciousness, rather than the old right versus left, religious versus secular, capitalist versus socialist, Eastern versus Western, Northern versus Southern, that is going to help us, because the aim is, as I said, to change structures and to change beliefs. I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful question and wonderful answer. And it reminded me when my book came out, Lawyers as Peacemakers, Practicing Holistic Problem Solving Law, the ABA published it, and I thought, wow, you know, we finally have made a huge milestone here that the ABA would publish that. And then when the ABA Journal interviewed me, they didn't actually even review the book. They asked me a question, and I spoke from my experience as a mother about the question. I raised 16 children that I had taken in off the streets and so forth, and I used an example from my life, and it was one of those attacks that kind of took me by surprise. Here I was just, you know, offering this alternative way, and the backlash from the people on the internet and out in the community was just shocking. And in fact, one of the things somebody said was that I couldn't possibly have anything to say because I was talking about being a mother.
Well, that's the devaluation of caring and caregiving right there.
Yes,
because
exactly.
It's associated with, well, you know that in the United States, in this wealthy nation, women over the age of 65 are twice as likely to be poor as men over 65. These are Census Bureau figures. And it's not just job discrimination. It's because most of these women were or are either full or part-time caregivers, and poverty is their reward, and we can't have that. It is not only wrong, but as I said, it is economically in the post-industrial era not to give value to this work, not to give training for it, not to really focus on what it contributes is crazy. So thank you for what you said and what you did. But it's not going to change overnight. But you know, we do have the knowledge historically. I sometimes joke about it. I say when I get depressed, I think of the European Middle Ages. Why? Because they looked a lot like the Taliban. You know, the Inquisition, the Crusades, the witch burnings, you know, whether you publicly torture a woman by fire or by stoning her to death, it's the same. It's exemplary public violence to terrorize a socially disempowered group into submission. And we moved from that, didn't we, at least in the West? Sure, I mean, there are some lousy Western policies, but hey, you and I couldn't be having this conversation. We couldn't be having this webinar if we hadn't moved more to the partnership side. It's not a question of Western or Eastern, Muslim or Christian. I mean, you said my child's in the blade is in 23 languages. Actually, it's now in 25. And the last one it just got published in was in Urdu, in Pakistan. I mean, there are people all over the world, and I'm in touch with many of them, who are working to move to the partnership side, who get it, that this is not a question of Western or Eastern or Muslim or Christian or Jewish or Hindu or whatever. It's partnership or domination systems, and that's the issue for our future.
That's great. Now, I would like to hear from some other folks on the call, and I'm specifically wondering what lessons we can take from this story into our own lives and our practices, and how can we be evolutionary social activists as lawyers. And last week people were a little reluctant to address that question.
Well, I can address it for you, if I may. I just wrote a chapter for a Cambridge University book on crimes against humanity, and mine was the only chapter on crimes against the majority, women and children. And I propose in this chapter something that may seem a bit far out, but it comes from my legal training, that we need to use international law, the Rome Statute, especially the section on crimes against humanity, to include women and children, to include gender and childhood, and that we have to do this not only for the millions and millions whose lives are blighted and taken worldwide through these horrible traditions of domination, you know, domestic violence, of course, we hear about, but, you know, all the way from genital mutilation, giving less food to girl children, child brides, tremendous amount of physical violence against children, not only in homes, but in schools, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is something that lawyers could get behind, could really, I mean, get their organizations to take it on, to really say, well, wait a minute, you know, I mean, you talk about all of these crimes that are committed by these heads of government, but let's really look at the crimes that they condone in their societies. That, for example, much of Southeast Asia has no laws against violence against women and children, okay? So that's a very specific thing where I continue to use my legal training and where I really want to invite people to be engaged.
And so do you have any particular organizations that you
I tell you, I've been so busy with the Caring Economics campaign, but I so impassionately care about this whole issue of violence against the majority, about violations of the human rights of the majority, which are women and children, worldwide, that I wrote this chapter. And as I said, it was the only chapter in that book. Everything else was about the environment. And I mean, the environment is important, but I recently spoke at the 65th United Nations General Assembly, and I said the truth, that you can't tack on balance with nature to a fundamentally imbalanced system that devalues caring and caregiving, that devalues the female half of humanity. It just isn't going to happen.
We do talk about Mother Nature after all, don't we?
Yeah. And this happened to be a session sponsored by Bolivia, which, of course, the Pachamama and all of that. So it was a good opportunity for me to bring that in. But as I said, again, I was the only one at that session who talked about women and children, and it's ridiculous. So it's up to us to change it. But I would love to see a lawyers organization, like a progressive lawyers organization, work with other progressive, like women lawyers organizations, in the so-called developing world, in the global south, on this. It could make a huge difference.
Well, I mean, and I am aware of quite a few women who have, they just all happen to be women, who have who are lawyers who have taken up the cause of human trafficking.
Absolutely. Well, that's part of it, sure. But that's only one part of it. It's just one part of it. I mean, if you look, I'll tell you what, I let me email you the chapter. Then those who are interested, if you want to do something with it, I'll be happy to consult to your efforts. I mean, I put ideas out there, and sometimes they're picked up, and sometimes I manage to help them be picked up, as through the Caring Economics campaign. We also have the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence as part of a Center for Partnership Studies program. You can read about that on partnershipway.org. And there's a fabulous Caring and Connected Parenting Guide, very short, on that website. But, you know, we're talking about building a partnership movement, a caring economics movement, aren't we?
Well, and you probably do not know this, but my first job out of law school was I was the executive director of the Sexual and Physical Abuse Resource Center in Gainesville, Florida. And I was a guardian ad litem representing children in neglect, abuse, and sexual abuse cases. And then I raised 16 children. So this is definitely near and dear to my heart.
Well, I'd love to see you take a lead on it. I have to tell you, I mean, it's only people, one by one, that we make the difference. And that goes back to that question about consciousness. Once we're conscious that there are ways of changing the system, that the system can change. I mean, if you look at modern history, Western history, it's not an upward linear movement from the Middle Ages to now, but it is a spiral movement with dips, and we are in another dip right now, but that's exactly the time when you have to have positive alternatives.
Well, and I think that as lawyers, we have the opportunities that to make those differences and to find our particular niche and the thing that we're passionate about, and whether we do it as a full-time job or if we do it as a sideline that we have a different job that supports our call it pro bono work. Whatever it is, that we have a lot more opportunities than we sometimes realize.
Yes.
And it sometimes looks like just another thing to put on our to-do list, when it's really the thing that that will actually shift our quality of life as well as the quality of life of a lot of other people.
Well, you know, I mean, if you're talking balancing life and work, you can't unless you happen to have the kind of policies that you have in Sweden, Norway, Finland, Germany, et cetera. I mean, you know, I don't care how much you do in terms of time management. It won't work. I mean, as so many women who are dropping out, or we're dropping out before the economic crisis. No, so we're really talking about laying the foundations. This is very foundational work that we're talking about that goes beyond the symptoms to some of the causes.
And Kim, thank you, Rianne. It looks like we have another hand up.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, James. Go ahead, James.
Hello, this is James O.D. Hi, Molly. Hi, Kim. Hi, Rianne.
Hi, James.
So good to hear this conversation. Truly inspiring. And I ask Rian, you know, in this concept of the Alliance for a Caring Economy, what is the role for changing our punishment paradigm? Because we, of course, we now see the intricate involvement of the prison industrial complex in making profit from warehousing people in the name of punishment and only creating more and more criminals. And I think it's at the root of much of your philosophy, of course, that the punishment paradigm is an uncaring, male-dominated paradigm that is totally archaic at this point from the perspective of new science and humanism. So that's my basic question.
Well, you've answered it, haven't you, James? It's really part of a domination system, you know, where you have a morality of coercion, of punishment, rather than of caring and of really giving people opportunities. And if you're in that paradigm, where there's only in the domination paradigm, where you see only two alternatives, you either dominate or you're dominated, you can't see reconstructive justice, which is what obviously you're referring to, which is a partnership trend, by the way. You know, I mean, the whole thing is that it's not just that it's so profitable for these companies that build prisons so that they can warehouse people and produce more and more criminals who will then fill their prisons and, you know, more and more profits. But it's the underlying value system that does not value caring for people, that really focuses on, as I said, a morality of coercion rather than caring. So as I said, I think we need to do both. We need to work on obviously, I mean, the data are there in terms of economic fiscal responsibility. This is a lunatic investment. It's crazy. Creates more and more problems. But see, this is the problem with GDP. All of this stuff is part of GDP. So that's why we need social wealth indicators. Do you see where I'm going here? If you don't change the underlying, and I'd love to see Noetic Sciences and some of the other organizations. We have some faith organizations as part of our alliance. I'd love to invite you to be part of it. It's so important, and I hope that you will call me or go to our website. Call me if you want to talk more about it. But go to our website and look at the information on ACE. We have to change the foundations. What is economically valuable? Never mind only the human costs, but just the pure, ridiculous nature of this, which has very little to do with what they keep talking about, which is fiscal responsibility, of course.
Indeed. Absolutely. Well, thank you. I'm going to sign off here.
Good, 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 good. Well, we want organizations. For ACE, it's a coalition of organizations representing faith communities, women, think tanks, children, socially responsible businesses, anything. I mean, we really need to build a movement for caring economics so that we don't have the same old, totally ludicrous conversation about socialism and capitalism, which is getting us nowhere.
Well,
because the Nordic nations have a very, as I said, a very healthy market economy, much healthier than ours because we don't have a free market with these huge, huge, huge companies, and very healthy government programs. But they have a caring economics, and they very often call themselves not socialists by any means, but caring societies.
Well, I want to thank you for all of this, and note that we're at the end of our hour, and I think we could go on for a long, long time. Thank you so much for the work you're doing in the world.
Well, thank you for the work you're doing in the world. And really, aside from being essential, it is such meaningful work, and you also come into contact with wonderful people. So let's do it.
Mm. Yes. Absolutely, absolutely. And I'll mention James Adee and I are leading a program, actually February 9th through the 12th, on lawyers as agents of evolutionary change, which you can find out about on the Cutting Edge Law website for anyone who is on this call that's interested in that. And we will be back on the 28th with Sharif Abdullah, and who is also a lawyer who is working on many of these same issues in the world. So, Rian, thank you so much.
Kim, excuse me. I would just also like to note to everybody that we will be posting this audio archive on the website where you signed up, as well as we will be sending it out to you in email. And I have a selfish request because I'm just blown away by tonight. And one of the last things that I would like to just ask, if possible, of you and Rian is, because we're gathered with these leading-edge lawyers here tonight, they're in the trenches, and although I'm not an attorney myself, I am sure that day-to-day there are challenges to keeping one's head above the water, because everyone here, I am sure, is ignited and ready to reactivate, if they haven't already, their original passion and purpose in the law. And I just acknowledge the commitment and the courage that everyone has here. And I wondered, Rian or Kim, if you have any closing comments for the group gathered surrounding day to day, and what if there's a practice or a thought or just anything that people can take with them this week that might help keep them above water?
Well, I think that my thought always is what I said earlier, that we really need to build foundations, because otherwise we're always on the margins. And one of those foundations is new economic indicators, like the social wealth indicators. And lawyers, I mean, you have the skill and the knowledge to really present ideas. So enroll in our Caring Economics webinars. They're going to be starting again in the in January, and then you can reach hundreds and thousands of others. I think that it's not going to happen overnight, but we are essential in making it happen. So do it.
And I'll go on the level of what you can do as a small action. And I think that one of the things that lawyers who think that they're just too busy to take on anything else can do is that they can actually be caring in the work that they're already doing. I think it's both what Rian said and that. It's about who we're being in our day-to-day life and then what we're doing in the world.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. It has been a pleasure to talk with all of you, and I look forward to working with you and having a real impact.
Many blessings,
thank you,
on your work. Thanks.
Good night, and thank you so much, everyone, and see you the week after that for Sharif Abdullah.
Yeah, we're taking the Thanksgiving week off, and we'll be back on the 28th, and we'll be back in the morning at our regular time.
8 a.m. Pacific. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
You are currently the only person in this conference.